Trump's act, executive order, will stand up in the courts. So in that sense, it's a distraction, but it points us to the real issue, which is private power dominating public interests involving technology.
Could Twitter delete Trump's account?
Twitter could potentially, but I don't think they're going to engage in that task. I think what they're actually going to do is continue to label his tweets in this particular way, but we're going to see continued backlashes accordingly as well.
Ramesh Srinivasan, we have to have you back on, but I want to thank you for being with us, professor in the Department of Information Studies, Design Director at UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. If you want to sign up for our daily quarantine report, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. during the pandemic, featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year-round, located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
If you have enjoyed our music, our entertainment, our public affairs, our news, and you appreciate the fact that while we are sheltering in place, your mind can travel elsewhere, please remember that we are in need of your financial support if you are able. Keep us strong and keep us on the air. In lieu of our spring drive, we're asking people to donate via the website at kboo.fm/give. Give as your heart and your pocket allow, because we know everyone is going through. But we want to remain here for you so we can make it through together.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds gather in Portland to protest the deaths of people of color at the hands of police. An anti-lockdown freedom rally is scheduled in Hermiston, Oregon, tomorrow morning. And in national news, a Minneapolis police officer has been charged with murder in the death of George Floyd. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 29th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. One person was arrested overnight during Portland protests over the death of George Floyd while in Minneapolis police custody. Floyd died on Monday after a police officer knelt on his neck for 9 minutes. The incident was captured on a bystander video, which quickly went viral, resulting in the firing of Officer Derek Chauvin and 3 other officers. In Portland, protesters gathered in front of the Multnomah County Justice Center, holding signs in solidarity with Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement. The protests continued into the evening, with about 100 people marching through downtown Portland. They chanted George Floyd's name, Black Lives Matter, and I Can't Breathe, the words that Floyd kept repeating before he died. During a Thursday morning press conference, the Portland Police Bureau denounced Floyd's death at the hands of police officers. Acting Chief Chris Davis described Floyd's death as, quote, a big step in the wrong direction, and went on to say, in our profession, we have a problem, particularly with marginalized communities and communities of color. Davis said that the PPB would try to remain uninvolved in the planned protests and recognize that the presence of police at protests against them could be triggering. But as protesters blocked the streets near the Justice Center overnight, police arrived in riot gear and a 20-year-old man was reportedly arrested for interfering with a police officer and resisting arrest. This morning, hundreds of people attended a demonstration called A Eulogy for Black America at Terry Schrunk Plaza across from City Hall. The demonstration was organized by the Portland NAACP. Their intention was to bring renewed attention to the people of color who have died at the hands of police officers who have sworn to serve and protect, and they called on well-intentioned Americans to take a stand. Religious leaders, Urban League CEO Nkenje Harman-Johnston, City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, and others took part in the demonstration. Speaking to the crowd, Hardesty said, quote, "Over and over and over again, black people have been killed and there has been silence from the majority community," end quote. A vigil for George Floyd is scheduled for 6 p.m. this evening in Peninsula Park. KBOO News is collecting responses from our community. If you would like to share your thoughts with the news team, leave us a message at this number, 971-801-1378. We may air your responses next week. Just after 10:30 p.m. last night, a Washington County man was shot and killed by deputies of the county sheriff's office. The officers were responding to multiple calls from neighbors reporting shouting coming from an apartment at 8585 Southwest Canyon Lane in the unincorporated area between Beaverton and Portland. Officers reportedly spoke to a woman at the location before attempting to take the man into custody. As they did so, the man pulled out a knife and was shot by the deputies. The sheriff's office did not disclose the man's name or how many deputies fired their guns. The office said that an investigation is underway by the county's major crimes team. The team is made up of investigators from several police agencies. The largest city in eastern Oregon will be the site of the Hermiston Freedom Rally tomorrow. For more on the story, here's KBOO's Ray Bodwell.
Noted right-wing provocateur Joey Gibson will be one of the featured speakers at tomorrow's Hermiston Freedom Rally. The rally is scheduled to start at noon on Festival Street in what organizers call an information campaign and an opportunity to gather to show support for the constitutional right to gather. In a statement, event organizer Colin Hodges said, quote, "The Bill of Rights guarantees us the freedom to assemble, the freedom of religion, the freedom to choose how we interact and how we do business," end quote. Speakers include Umatilla County Commissioner candidate Holly Jo Beers, Jonathan Lopez of Hermiston's Hispanic Advisory Committee, and Mark Hodges, Colin's father and former coach of the Hermiston High School football team. In a Facebook post, Colin Hodges said the rally is not about race or politics, but about togetherness, the First Amendment, and a return to normalcy. But Gibson's association with group Patriots Prayer and its connection to the right-wing extremist group the Proud Boys has city officials concerned. Hermiston Police Chief Jason Edmiston said his department was preparing as it would for any other city event, but added, quote, "We have some concerns in regards to the history involving Mr. Gibson and some of the other groups that support him." The Proud Boys have been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Gibson is currently under indictment and faces charges for inciting a riot as a result of a street fighting incident in Portland last May in which a woman was knocked unconscious and sent to the hospital with injuries. Despite Gibson's history, Hodges defended him by saying, quote, "He's a good person. He's smart. He knows the Constitution," end quote. He said that Gibson's experience with politics and in protests made him the ideal speaker to invite. As of Wednesday, there were nearly 100 confirmed attendees on the group's Facebook page. But many residents of Hermiston pushed back against the event because of the possibility of additional spread of the coronavirus within the community. Hodges dismissed those concerns as quack science and said that people are blindly listening to lies told by leaders and health officials. Event organizers have encouraged people to attend with or without masks. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Oregon officials distributed nearly 1,000 masks and 5,000 gallons of hand sanitizer to farm workers this week in an effort to limit the spread of COVID-19 during harvest season. The Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Oregon National Guard distributed supplies at 18 sites statewide this week and were met by thousands of farmers. The state has recognized farm workers as a particularly vulnerable group since they often live and work in close quarters. Oregon farms typically employ seasonal migrant workers, many of whom are Latinx, the group that has been hit hardest by COVID-19 in Oregon. State officials announced Thursday that 48 seasonal workers at Townsend Farms near Portland had already tested positive for the virus. State workplace regulators moved to increase sanitation measures on farms and put more distance between workers in early May. These rules will go into effect on June 1st. This week, the state limited farmers to 10 masks per employee in an attempt to make supplies last, although many hands-on laborers go through a mask a day. The Oregon Department of Agriculture will be working with farm worker community organizations to distribute more supplies throughout the busy harvest season. The Oregon Health Authority has committed to new transparency provisions in response to the outbreak at Townsend Farms in Fairview. An initial outbreak at Townsend Farms only became public after a second one involving 48 migrant workers surfaced. Previously, the Health Authority was not alerting the public to outbreaks related to particular workplaces. The initial outbreak at Townsend Farms resulted in 53 infections that the public did not know were related. The initial Townsend outbreak appears to be the largest in the entire state. However, that cannot be said for sure since the health authority has not been reporting workplace outbreaks. Now, the OHA is committed to sharing that information and telling the public about any workplace outbreak greater than 5 infections. Patrick Allen, the director of the Oregon Health Authority, announced that in a news release, saying, quote, "The COVID-19 pandemic demands that we all rethink how we accomplish necessary tasks that are vital to our roles. OHA believes a consistent, transparent, statewide approach to reporting COVID-19 cases in workplaces will give Oregonians more information to help people avoid the risks of COVID-19 infection. We want to ensure employers, workers, and customers know the same criteria will apply, no matter where they work or what businesses they support, everywhere in Oregon." Allen cited previous caution about patient privacy rights as one of the reasons for the lack of disclosure. Now the OHA will take the lead among local public health departments and disclose past and future workplace outbreaks. New uses of food waste have additional side benefits for the environment. With more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Edible food is wasted on a massive scale in the United States, but there are signs that it could be coming back to Americans' plates. The Upcycled Food Association has officially defined upcycled food, paving the way for a certification program akin to organic labeling later this year. One member company, Kaskai, makes beverages from the byproducts of coffee fruits. Joel Geldertz is the company's co-founder and an Oregon native.
I really like this kind of yin and yang dichotomy of taking something that was considered waste and turning it into something premium, and how consumers react to that as well, that they're eating something that's literally thrown on the ground and that somehow has been turned into a very premium and functional product.
The association defines upcycled foods as using ingredients that otherwise would not have gone to human consumption, are procured and produced using verifiable supply chains, and have a positive impact on the environment. As much as 40% of food is wasted, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Food production also accounts for about a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions, meaning cutting down on food waste could also be key in the fight against climate change. In addition, Geldertz says some byproducts of coffee are harmful to the environment, and yet millions of tons are dumped each year.
Because of the caffeine and polyphenol content in coffee fruit, it was naturally toxic to aquatic life.
Geldertz notes these substances in coffee fruit waste are not harmful to humans, but some animal species are sensitive to them. Geldertz believes once they become more visible in grocery stores, upcycled foods could take off. That could be especially true in the Pacific Northwest, which he sees as more conscious of food and sustainability issues.
So I think the Northwest is a really great place for products like these to be introduced, and I think they'll naturally have support in the community.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland is edging closer to turning some streets into pedestrian plazas. Yesterday, the Portland Bureau of Transportation opened up applications for a healthy business permit as a part of the Bureau's Safe Streets initiative. According to the PBOT website, the objective is to help businesses use more public space to conduct business safely. Business owners can apply for a healthy business permit online in a process that will take 10 to 20 minutes to complete. Prior to completing the application, the Bureau asks that businesses determine what they will use the public right-of-way space for and to coordinate with neighbors to see if they also need a public right-of-way. Once a group of business owners or organizations are aligned, they are requested to define what parts of the sidewalk, street, or parking area they need and what the intended purpose is. The site notes that emergency and disability access must be maintained and that businesses must follow state and county guidelines relative to COVID-19. If the permit is approved, they are issued at no charge and are valid until October 1st of this year. PBOT is even considering closing entire blocks if it doesn't conflict with buses or emergency vehicles. Southeast Belmont and Northeast 28th in the Kearns neighborhood have already been suggested, but other neighborhoods are expected to apply as well. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, we'll hear The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather calls for partly cloudy skies with temperatures dropping into the mid-60s. Tomorrow, we'll see a rainy day with temperatures in the low 60s. On this date in 1851, Sojourner Truth addressed the first Black Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio. The quote of the day is from Sojourner Truth, who said, quote, "Life is a hard battle anyway. If we laugh and sing a little as we fight the good fight of freedom, it makes it all go easier. I will not allow my life's light to be determined by the darkness around me." Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was arrested this morning and charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd earlier this week. In a bystander video, Officer Derek Chauvin can be seen pinning George Floyd to the ground with his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes until Floyd becomes immobile and stops breathing. Floyd's family said in a statement, quote, "The arrest of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for the brutal killing of George Floyd is a welcome but overdue step on the road to justice." They also stated they had expected a first-degree murder charge. Third-degree murder means that the offender did not have intent to kill, but someone died by, quote, "perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life." Chauvin, who had been with the police department for 19 years, racked up over a dozen prior police conduct complaints that resulted in no disciplinary action. The investigation into the actions of the other three officers involved in the incidents is ongoing. A CNN reporting team was arrested on live television early this morning while covering the protests in Minneapolis, which erupted in the wake of George Floyd's death in police custody. Police detained CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez, a producer and a photojournalist, while they were reporting live near a police precinct building that was earlier set ablaze. Before the arrest, Jimenez could be seen identifying himself as a reporter and offering to move wherever the police wanted. An officer responded by grabbing Jimenez's arm and putting him in handcuffs. The crew was released from custody an hour after their arrest with the help of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who took responsibility for the incident in a public apology. The Minneapolis State Patrol later said that the CNN crew was arrested in an attempt to clear the Minneapolis streets and were released once their identities as members of the media were confirmed. CNN disputed this claim, saying the crew identified themselves on live television. The event sparked outrage from First Amendment advocates and prominent journalists. Christian Amanpour, CNN's chief national anchor, wrote on Twitter that, quote, "Arresting journalists is the kind of thing that happens in dictatorships and authoritarian regimes. We live in a democracy," end quote. Advocates have also questioned if Jimenez's arrest was tied to his identity as Black and Latino. Amid rising tensions in Minneapolis, Jimenez was back on the air shortly after his release this morning. For the second time this week, Twitter has applied a label to one of Donald Trump's tweets. Regarding the unrest in Minneapolis, Trump tweeted, quote, "The thugs are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd, and I won't let that happen." He went on to say that he has spoken to the governor and told him that the military was with him, concluding his tweet with, quote, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts. Thank you." Twitter obscured the president's comments, saying they violated Twitter's rules about glorifying violence. Twitter's action came the day after the president signed an executive order limiting the liability protections for social media companies. That order came after Twitter labeled two of Trump's tweets as promoting misinformation, with a note that said, quote, "Get the facts about mail-in ballots." In the tweets, Trump had claimed that mail-in votes would lead to a rigged election in November and enable voter fraud. Trump and many conservatives have long claimed that Twitter is biased against them, but independent reviews have not shown that to be the case. The president of the Consumer Technology Association called Trump's executive order unconstitutional and ill-considered, and many legal experts question whether the order will stand up in court. Many Democrats expressed support for Twitter, but questioned why the company didn't add similar warnings to other baseless Trump tweets, such as the recent ones accusing MSNBC host Joe Scarborough of murdering a staff member in his Florida office 20 years ago. Scarborough was in Washington at the time, and the coroner's report ruled that the death was an accident. Republican voters against Trump plan to spend big on the 2020 campaign, and Trump signed an executive order attacking social media companies. With more on those stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
You know, it's geared to voters that don't like the president, but are historically Republican voters and for whom, you know, it's a big ask to go vote for a Democrat.
Republican operative Tim Miller is an advisor for a new effort that's planning to spend $10 million called Republican Voters Against Trump. They're gathering testimonials from people who identify with the Republican Party but don't want to vote for the current president this November.
Where Trump might have checked a lot of Republican policy boxes, from a leadership standpoint and a moral leadership standpoint, he just is totally out of step with all the things that we were taught when we became Republicans were supposedly important.
Yesterday, President Trump signed an executive order that would make it so social media companies are liable for the information their users post, breaking from a law that's been in place since 2006. Trump acknowledged the order will likely be challenged in court. This comes on the heels of Twitter fact-checking tweets from the president himself, since Twitter has added warning labels to hundreds of tweets, including one by a spokesperson from China's foreign ministry that claimed the coronavirus originated in the U.S. Law professor Gregory Magarian from Washington University in St. Louis says there's no constitutional argument for the executive order, that it's exactly what the First Amendment says the government may not do.
What we're talking about here is the president of the United States objecting to what he sees in his view as something that goes against his own ideology, his own political position, what he's calling bias against conservative views. And his response to that is to use the power of government to try to suppress the speakers that he is unhappy with.
Psychology professor Lisa Fazio from Vanderbilt University suspects Trump was waiting for an opportunity to make a move like this. She says the label Twitter put on the president's tweets about voting by mail being fraudulent was quite mild.
It didn't say they were false. It didn't take them down. It didn't reduce the distribution. All it said was get the facts. And then if you actually clicked on it, you would see kind of additional articles and tweets that put it in a larger context and showed why the information was wrong.
In addition to misinformation coming from the president, many election officials are concerned about foreign interference. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, a Republican, is one of them, especially after Russia's social media disinformation campaign in 2016.
Where I'm most alert to that right now is that it's right out of the Russians' playbook, for that matter, the North Koreans and the Iranians and others, to use an existing emergency, such as the one that we're in right now, to exploit existing fears and to sow division.
In an unusual move, the National Security Agency publicly accused the Russian government of trying to hack email servers around the world. It could indicate the agency is being aggressive against foreign interference ahead of the election less than 5 months away. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Tribes in Minnesota are starting to carefully reopen casinos. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After closing in mid-March to slow the spread of COVID-19, many tribes in Minnesota are reopening their casinos. Reporter Melissa Townsend has more.
Joe Nequinemi, the head of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe's corporate ventures, said the decision to close was a difficult one. But he says the decision to reopen is even more difficult.
It's harder because there's this fact that we will be increasing the same risk that we were trying to avoid by closing.
The Upper Sioux community opened their doors earlier in May. The Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux community, Prairie Island Indian community, the Red Lake Nation, and the Mille Lacs and Boys Fort Bands of Ojibwe casinos are all reopening this week. Angela Hykus is president and CEO of the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux community gaming enterprise.
We are really watching and understanding the guidance coming from the federal government, the CDC, different health organizations, coming from the state of Minnesota. We also have our own tribal public health department.
The casinos are not opening to full capacity so that patrons can practice social distancing. Customers will have their temperatures taken at the entrances. Shakopee is requiring everyone to wear masks. Mille Lacs is not. Other tribes around the country are also reopening their casinos. Jason Giles, Muscogee Creek, is executive director of the National Indian Gaming Association.
To be honest, it's not without its hiccups right off the bat. I mean, there's been already reports of employees showing up asymptomatic, but they have the virus. There's been other reports of, you know, people showing up not wearing a mask.
Giles says there are some tribes who say they will not reopen their casinos in the near future.
There's plenty of tribes in South Dakota and North Dakota, Arizona, New Mexico, some of the tribes that just don't have strong healthcare systems on the reservation and are a commute away from the nearest hospital, they are at particular risk if the virus starts to spread.
Here in Minnesota, tribal casino heads say they will pay close attention to what's happening and adjust as needed.
That was Melissa Townsend reporting. Minnesota's Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, a citizen of the White Earth Nation, is speaking out as people in Minneapolis protest the death of George Floyd, an African-American man who died in police custody this week.
It goes without saying that no one should be treated differently by law enforcement due to the color of their skin, and no one should live in fear of law enforcement because of the color of their skin. The grief in this moment is unbearable.
Members of the Native community are among those calling for justice and drawing attention to police violence against people of color, including Native Americans. Cell phone video from Monday's incident showed George Floyd face down on the ground, with a white police officer kneeling on the back of his neck. Floyd says he can't breathe and appears to go unconscious. Thousands of people protested in Minneapolis Tuesday and Wednesday. The Minneapolis Police Department fired four officers involved, and the city's mayor is calling for their prosecution. The president of the Navajo Nation announced what he says is good news in the tribe's fight against COVID-19. President Jonathan Nez, in a virtual town hall this week, said the curve is flattening, pointing to health department statistics showing the peak was reached on the Navajo Nation in April. Nez says it's due to a majority of citizens following emergency orders.
The things that you were all doing, Navajo Nation public, worked by staying home.
As of Wednesday, the tribe reported nearly 5,000 positive COVID-19 cases, more than 150 deaths, and more than 1,000 recoveries. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Private student loan borrowers are facing hidden payments and increasing interest on unpaid loans during the pandemic. With more on the story, we go again to Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Congress has granted federal student loan borrowers a reprieve during the pandemic, but the market has been less forgiving for people with private loans. Stephanie O'Donnell-Peters is a massage therapist in Portland, out of work since mid-March. Combined, she and her husband have student loan payments of $1,000 a month. When their loan manager, Firstmark Services, offered to pause payments for 3 months, they agreed, not realizing that interest would accrue at 7.5% each month.
To have to make a $1,000 payment, or probably closer to like $1,200 or $1,300 at that point, I just don't know how that's going to work.
O'Donnell Peters, who is a self-employed small business owner, has struggled to get unemployment from Oregon's overburdened system. The forbearance on the couple's loans ends this month. Firstmark Services did not respond by deadline to a request for comment. borrowers held more than $120 billion in private debt in 2019, according to analytics company Measure One. Jessica Thompson with the Institute for College Access and Success says private education loans have fewer protections than federal loans, such as being able to discharge the debt in the case of permanent disability. She says folks give up their safety net when they take out private loans.
You are at the mercy of your lender and what they're willing to work with you to do to keep you from defaulting, basically. That's very different than Congress looking at what essentially is directly on their books.
Thompson notes that help for private borrowers would require Congress to step in and make payments to private entities. But she says there is a small chance of relief. House Democrats' $3 trillion HEROES Act includes debt cancellation up to $10,000 for distressed borrowers, although Senate Republicans have balked at the bill's price tag. Thompson says the struggle to get aid underscores the nature of private student loans.
It highlights what we have long known is a lot of risk inherent in these products. They are market-based products.
She urges people with private debt to contact their lenders and stay informed about their options. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 29th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Nat Moon, Althea Billings, Ray Bodwell, and Hannah Mersbach. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is the always reliable Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K2